So I'm going to speak about Vajrapani, another facet of enlightenment. So when I was at Guhyaloka about 4 years ago, Guhyaloka is the Spanish retreat centre where men go to get ordained, and I was on a 4 month retreat there. And I think just prior to me getting ordained, I was on out for a walk on my own. And walking down a fairly steep, rocky path, and in a kind of a world of my own, if you like, and I slipped, and I suddenly hit the ground, and I hit the rock, and the rock was so hard. That's all I remember. It was so hard, and I sort of whacked my hand down to try and protect myself, and I cut my hand because the rock was sharp. But it was such a jolt. It was such a jolt. I'd just been sort of going along, minding my own business, and suddenly, whack, I was on the ground and I was bleeding. Another incident, Phil and I were walking down Bethnal Green High Road, Bethnal Green Road, and going to the cinema or something. And I can remember we stepped off the curb. I don't know if you can remember this. Stepped off the curb, and a car just sort of came right up and suddenly put on its brakes. And Phil sort of put his hand out like that and stopped me from going any further. And it was almost like I felt the momentum of myself kind of carrying on ahead of me. But again, it was a real jolt. It really was like, wow, that was close. So fortunate, small little incidents. In a way, these sorts of things go on all the time. Just in the team meeting we've just had, I think the team have had several jolts today. The gas not working, the van breaking down, and various other things. But then there were bigger jolts, aren't there? The death of a loved one, for example. Even though we know about death, it's still a shock, isn't it, when you hear about someone's death. It's just like, oh, you can't believe it. You can't believe it. So I'm just starting off by talking about these kind of jolts that we have, these jolts in our lives. They might be small daily occurrences, or they might be bigger things. And it's almost like they break the thread of ourselves just for a moment. They break the thread of ourselves. We're going along, and then something happens, and the thread breaks. Usually, we try and kind of get the world, or kind of get reality to align itself with us, don't we? That's what we kind of try and do. Hopefully I'm not speaking out of turn here. I certainly can see this tendency in myself. I try and kind of get reality to kind of fit me, yeah, to try and fit me. But this is impossible. Yeah, this is impossible. Buddhism is saying that I need to align myself with reality, yeah, or we need to align ourselves with reality. So there's a lovely short sutta from the Pali Canon that shows this point. So the Pali Canon, I think, was quite an early commitment to writing down the teachings of the Buddha. For the first 400 years, the teaching of Buddhism was an oral tradition, and then it got committed to writing. So the Pali Canon is a quite a large body of teachings of the Buddha. And it's a sutta about someone called Ambattha. I think that's how you pronounce it. Forgive me if it's not right. Ambattha. And the Buddha was touring around Kosala, which is a district in North India, with 500 monks, it said. And he was staying in dense jungle. Yeah, so they'd found a secluded jungle clearing. They were staying there, meditating, living simply, and practicing. In the local area was a Brahmin teacher. So in India, there's the caste system. There was a caste system, and Brahmins were at the top. Yeah, the Brahmin caste was at the top of the caste system, and there was a Brahmin teacher in the area, and he was concerned because the Buddha had come along, and the Buddha's reputation goes before him, and it's very, very good, as you can imagine. So the Brahmin teacher was obviously getting a bit concerned because his own reputation was going to be undermined, and he was actually being supported by the king as well, so his supports were looking a bit fragile. So he'd heard the reputation of the Buddha, and he wanted to check it out and see what the situation was. So he sent one of his pupils, and his pupil was Ambattar. Yeah, so Ambattar was a kind of excellent pupil. He'd learnt all the scriptures, he knew how to chant the mantras, he was well versed in the Vedic Indian religion. And he was young and he was proud, and he was a bit cocksure of himself, and he was quite pleased to be able to go off and challenge the Buddha and see what this person knew. So he got in his chariot and set off to see the Buddha, and he got as far as he could in his chariot, and then he got on foot and started walking. He got to the clearing where the Buddha was staying, and he asked some monks where the Buddha is, and they said, he's in that hut, you can go and see him. And Ambattar walked to the hut, coughed to announce his presence, wiggled the bolt, and was accepted in by the Buddha. When we come into the shrine, one of the things we do is keep the shrine on our right out of respect, and we make offerings to the shrine out of respect, often out of respect. And imagine what it would be like if the Buddha was here, or if we met the Buddha, and we'd be respectful, wouldn't we? We'd show him respect. And there would probably be a form, there was certainly a form that when you read the Pali scriptures that, you salute the Buddha in a particular way, out of respect for his presence. Well, Ambattar just wasn't up to this. He was much too arrogant and too full of pride and self-righteousness. And he went into the Buddha's hut, and the Buddha was sat down, just sitting on the floor. And Ambattar didn't sit down. He kept pacing up and down the room. So it's in a way quite a rude thing to do in such good company. So, of course, the Buddha could see that Ambattar was kind of full of pride, and Ambattar, I won't go through it in detail, but he starts questioning the Buddha quite rudely, actually. He calls the Buddha a menial and talks about his lineage. Of course, Ambattar is looking at the Buddha from the point of view of who he thinks is superior sort of caste. Yeah, superior caste. Superior view of himself. And the Buddha starts then gently questioning Ambattar back. And he starts questioning Ambattar about his lineage. Yeah, and actually his lineage isn't quite what Ambattar is saying. And it gets to a point where the Buddha is asking Ambattar a question, and he refuses to answer it. So he's getting discovered. He refuses to answer the question, and the Buddha says, well, Ambattar, if I ask you a question, if you refuse to answer it, your head will split into seven pieces. And he needs to ask three times, so the Buddha again says, well, ask the question, and Ambattar refuses to announce it. to answer it. And he asks for a third time, with a third warning from the Buddha, well, if you don't answer this straightforward question, your head will split into seven pieces. At that moment, Vajrapani, the yaksha — a yaksha is a mischievous local deity spirit, I think. At that moment, Vajrapani, the yaksha, holding a huge iron club, flaming, ablaze and glowing up in the sky just above Ambattar, was thinking, if this young man Ambattar does not answer a proper question put to him by the Buddha, by the third time of asking, I'll split his head into seven pieces. The Lord saw Vajrapani, and so did Ambattar. And at that sight, Ambattar was terrified and unnerved. His hairs stood on end, and he sought protection and shelter and safety from the Buddha. So the sutra goes on for quite a long way, and I won't go into that, but I just want to use that introduction to Vajrapani quite early on in the Buddha's teachings. So I like this because the whole of Ambattar's identity kind of rests on this question, and the Buddha reality is kind of pushing towards Ambattar in a rather unnerving way, and beginning to undermine his identity, undermine who he thinks he is. And I think this is a really good example for us, certainly for me, often so full of kind of pride and thinking, I know what's right and I know what's wrong. Yeah? Very, very convinced by myself. We're all very, very convinced by ourselves, aren't we? But sooner or later we will get a whack. Yeah, whether we like it or not, sooner or later we will get a whack. So Vajrapani. Yeah. So you've seen an image of Vajrapani on the shrine. There's actually a small image here, so when you come up this evening, have a look at this image. This is the image I'm going to initially talk about, actually. This is an image of the wrathful Vajrapani. So there's a peaceful form and a wrathful form, and I'm going to talk about the wrathful form to begin with. So Vajrapani. Imagine a huge lotus flower. Upon the lotus is a sun disc. Standing on this is a huge bulk of a figure. He is deep blue and appears immensely powerful. He has a colossal body that swells with energy and power. He fills the sky. His legs are astride and he is stamping on corpses. Around his loins is a fresh tiger skin. A garland of human skulls hangs from his neck. Live snakes encircle his waist. He is surrounded by an aura of flames that emanate in all directions. He has a crown of five skulls on his head. His hair is black, wild, and dishevelled. He has three eyes which angrily glare and bulge. His mouth is open, snarling, showing white fangs. With his left hand, his gesture is to ward off demons. In his right, he holds a golden vajra, ready to hurl it. He roars like a thousand claps of thunder. Static lightning fills the sky, and wind roars in every direction. So this is Vajrapani. He is an aspect of reality, reality as energy. And he holds a diamond thunderbolt, a vajra, ready to hurl it. And a vajra is reality as well, immensely powerful and indestructible. So what's this doing in the middle of a Buddhist retreat? I thought Buddhism was about calmness and peace and quiet and having a nice time. And we've got this terrorist in our midst. But here he is, and he is a prominent figure, and he's on the shrine. And here he is in the room. So he's trying to involve us. Yeah, he's trying to involve us. He's trying to invoke our energy. Yeah. Okay. So one of the things that happened to Ambedkar when he came into contact with Vajrapani was that he was terrified. Fear arose in him. Yeah, so I'm just going to talk a bit about fear. And I think this is relevant to the image of Vajrapani trampling on corpses. He's trampling on corpses. So what are we afraid of? Yeah, what are you afraid of? Spiders, snakes, the dark, I am. Not getting what we want. Not getting what we want. I was just speaking to a few people at lunchtime about meditation. And kind of we want something from meditation, don't we? We want something from it. And I think there's fear, even at that level, of not getting something, of not getting something that we want out of meditation. Sometimes we can be afraid of getting what we want. I can be afraid of speaking in public. Being afraid of saying no, being afraid of saying yes. We can be afraid of being conventional. We can be afraid of being unconventional. We can be afraid of being judged or disliked. With the communication exercises, I don't know if you've experienced this, but sometimes when I do communication exercises, I feel fear. You know, I feel like before we start, you know, before you open your eyes, I just feel sort of anxiety, nervousness, fear. And it's there, you know, it's there in my experience, and I'm sure you've experienced that. We don't often like strong emotions. We're often afraid of strong emotions, afraid of strong emotions in others. We're afraid of strong emotions often in ourselves. A quote from Bhante Sangharakshita. We tend to like nice, gentle, soft, domesticated, tame, manageable emotions. We don't like violent emotions such as those of sex and anger. We react to people who are different to ourselves. They threaten us and represent the unmanageable and untamable. They represent the power of the non-rational. They all represent the possibility and also the danger or the breaking through of the rational mind. Another thing I was reminded of, actually, there's saw recently an exhibition in the Royal Festival Hall, and every year they have an exhibition called the World Press Photo. And I'm always struck by how emotional the images are. And some of the images that are there are very, very harrowing. It's just a free exhibition, and it's on once a year. And they're very, very powerful images. And when I was looking at those recently, I really realised how little of that we usually see, or I usually see in my life, even in the mainstream media. The actual level of emotional expression is often very shallow. Yeah. Okay. Also, perhaps we sometimes are afraid of living. We are afraid of dying, both literally and metaphorically. Perhaps we are afraid of being ourselves. So fear is an attempt to avoid being in relationship. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's a little bit about fear, but there's also another sort of fear that I'd like to touch on. Jarka was mentioning this, but fear as in awe, or fear as in wonder. Yeah, so fear of something bigger than ourselves, something beyond ourselves. And again, I think you can experience this in pujas. Yeah, so pujas are pointing to something that are beyond ourself, beyond our individual self. And when you come to do a puja, well, I think you can often experience fear. Yeah. An experience of fear I remembered was I was on retreat at Vajraloka, which is a meditation centre in Wales, and just coming out of the shrine room, and I went for a walk down the valley, and on the other side of the valley it was autumn, so the trees were, you know, just a real cacophony of colours, and I was really, really moved. The beauty of it really, really touched me, you know, just the colours of it. But I also could sort of see the impermanence, the change that was taking place. And in that mixture of beauty and seeing impermanence, there was a real fear. I found it all a bit too much, actually. So I've just been talking a little bit about our fears. In a way, I'm encouraging us to start noticing the fear that we have in our life. Yeah? I hope that doesn't sound too drastic. But just start noticing that we are afraid in probably lots of little situations. And there's an image from, the Greek tradition of this. You've probably heard of the Gorgon Medusa. So Medusa is the female form, and her hair is writhing snakes. Yeah, you probably know that image. Quite a terrifying image. And if you look at the Medusa, you turn to stone. And I think turning to stone is quite a good metaphor for fear. And Perseus is on a mission to kill this Medusa. She's mortal, and he's been given a sword, and he's been given a bronze shield so that he can see Medusa in the reflection of the shield, so he won't be turned to stone. So I like this image because it shows us that we can start moving towards our fear, but we don't have to do it directly. We can use a mirror to see some of the things that scare us in our life, so that we can start moving towards our fear. Some of the mirrors can be things like friendship. Yeah, friends can let you know what you're like, some of the bits of yourself you can't see or you don't know about. Pujas, again, can be mirrors for ourselves. Dreams, yeah, having dreams, they can be mirrors for who we are in a more imaginative way. Okay, so when you experience fear, if you start to notice yourself experience fear, even if it's in a short conversation in the tea area, suddenly the words might stop and you're both stood there and you don't know what to say, and suddenly you feel a little bit tense in your stomach. Yeah, it's a little bit awkward. Well, that's sort of fear, isn't it? It's sort of fear of something other than you. It's fear of a situation which actually you're not quite in control of. It doesn't quite fit your shape. So just start to be mindful of those small experiences. So what happens when you start to become aware of your fear, aware of emotions, is that you start to realise you've got energy. We've all got energy, and this is another aspect of Vajrapani. He's immensely energetic, completely free energy. And I think this is particularly illustrated by his aura of flames. Yeah, he's standing within a huge aura of flames. So where does energy come from? Well, if you're a geologist, you would say energy comes from the earth. If you're a car driver, you might say energy comes from the engine. If you're a lover, you might say energy comes from passion. If you're an athlete, you might say energy comes from carbohydrates. If you're a scientist, you might say energy comes from the collision of atoms. If you're a Buddhist, you would say energy comes from the mind. But a better question might be, what do we do with our energy? Yeah, we've all got energy. What do we do with it? What do you do with your energy? Probably what most of us do is we pursue what interests and pleases us. Yeah, that seems to be what we do. It certainly seems to be what I do. I use my energy in the pursuit of what pleases me and what interests me. Just notice a very small example of this the other day. In the cook's break, when you come and join us to chop veg, and then we have a cup of tea in the area out the back, and then what we do is we open a box of chocolates, and I don't think there were many other chocolates on retreat, because there's an enormous amount of sort of, quite a lot of energy suddenly gets aroused, and I've even found myself reading the little labels on each of the quality streets, sort of instruction map. So it's suddenly like that's where my energy is flowing. It's flowing in that direction. It's flowing into what pleases me and what interests me. And, you know, our modern cities, modern life is designed, isn't it? It's designed to interest and please us in all sorts of fascinating and wonderful ways. So yeah, just be aware of how you use your energy, what you are doing with your energy. Look where your energy flows. Also another area to be aware of is how we kind of waste our energy. Yeah, it's really, really easy to waste energy, getting involved in or encouraging things like nagging or moaning or criticising others, or just generally not being very positive. You know, moaning is quite a good example. You know, just sort of, we're using energy actually when we moan. It's very, very easy to moan about life, but actually we're using our energy when we do that. Also, we can sort of block our energy, can't we? We can block our energy, particularly if we feel strong emotions. Perhaps we don't want to feel them, or perhaps some emotions we feel ashamed of or a bit guilty of. So just be aware that actually your emotions, our emotional life, is our energetic life, and we need that energy. Yeah, we need that energy. If we're going to meditate, we need energy. Yeah, if we're going to practice ethics, we need energy. So just be aware that your emotions have your energy, and somehow we need to find a way to channel that energy, to use our energy. What we need to do is really find ways of putting our energy into what is most important in our lives, into what is most crucial in our lives. Okay, so I've talked a little bit about fear, I've talked about a little bit about energy, and just going to talk a little bit about heroism. Yeah, so heroism. So there's lots of stories of the Buddha facing his fear, particularly before he was enlightened, going to dense jungles, meditating there, feeling the experience of fear, but just continuing to do what he was doing. I was also thinking about the Buddha. I don't know if you know, but his going forth. So he went forth from a life of luxury into a homeless life. He went forth from a life of status into a life of no status. He went forth from home life into the homeless life, and he left behind kind of style and fashion and power and comfort, all these things that we held on to and attached to. He went forth from them. He was sort of fearless in letting go of these things. So, just thinking about sort of using our energy skillfully, and I think those are exemplified in the positive precepts. So, a hero always acts. That's sort of one of the things that a hero does. You don't often see a hero just kind of lying around watching telly, waiting to go out later on. A hero is someone who acts. They act very fully. They're always ready to act. And often the heroes that we see, perhaps on our screens, are, they may be heroic, but they're also often violent. They do sometimes have very positive qualities. I watched Alien recently, and Sigourney Weaver, I thought, was really, really heroic in that film. Sort of fantastic image of heroic activity. But for us, it's unlikely we're going to meet aliens. But we can be heroic in other ways through our actions. So we can be heroic in how we act, in the deeds that we do with our body. We can act in ways that bring about loving kindness, or we can be willing to abandon our self-involvement or our self-interest and be generous instead, a heroic act of generosity. We can be heroic in practicing stillness. I think that's quite a heroic act, actually. Just even in a shrine room, just sitting still. Subhadramati was talking about sitting still the other day. It's quite heroic just to be able to really honestly sit still, without moving, and really be with your experience. I think that's a really heroic thing. Practicing contentment rather than always wanting something from reality or wanting something more. Also, truthful communication. So just being able to speak truthfully and clearly. And practicing mindfulness. Practicing mindfulness in all sorts of situations. Just being aware of your body, being aware of your thoughts, being aware of your actions. So I think these are really heroic sort of qualities. Okay, so if we can practice these things, then we will become free. This is what's being pointed at. These positive precepts are kind of illustrations of how the Buddha would be. So the Buddha couldn't cause violence. He couldn't do it. We obviously can, but we can practice not doing it. We can move towards not doing it. So through the practice of these precepts, we can start to become free. We can start to, in a way, start to jolt ourselves out of ourselves. So Vajrapani, his energy is completely in the pursuit of the good. This is Vajrapani's energy. It's completely in pursuit of the good. It's called virya, energy in pursuit of the good. So when we have seen, when we have seen through ourselves, when we're no longer bound by our own self-involvement, we will see Vajrapani differently. And I think this is where the peaceful form comes in. So the peaceful form of Vajrapani is, again, royal blue in colour. And he sits in a posture of royal ease. So he's completely at peace. There's absolutely no tension. There's no loss of energy, actually. There's no loss of energy, but he's completely at peace. His wild hair is now being tied back with a silk blue bow. And he the Vajra now balances in his hand in perfect poise. So he's completely at ease with this energy. Yeah, this energy. And, just to finish off, actually, I'm just going to finish with a continuation from the Medusa. So when the Medusa is killed, what arises from the Medusa's body is Pegasus. And Pegasus is a white winged horse. So this is what emerges from the body of or the relinquishing of fear. You know, you get this beautiful imaginative horse with wings, so grace and power. Yeah. And Pegasus then went on to carry the lightning and thunder for Zeus. I really like that. So you've just got this real power and beauty. And at one point, Pegasus kicks the earth. Yeah, his hoof kicks the earth. And out of that contact arises a spring, and it's the spring of the muses. So I think that's another aspect of overcoming fear, is that your imagination can begin to flow. Thank you.